Twilight there between. It's like, when does the not time end and the time begin?
Oh, you remember when Geshe Kakar was saying, now it is class time?
Yeah, yeah, right. Well, if you believe time is a permanent principle, yeah, that creates everything.
All right. Okay, so I'm going to start. Just one procedural thing is that, so I was thinking if people had more questions, that the time to have those produced would be by the end of the break before the last session. It was a short break after this session before the last session. And if we get questions in that time frame, then in the last half of the last session, then we can get to them, especially if they're legible, which almost all of them were last time. I had a little difficulty with one, but it wasn't that it was illegible. It's just that while I'm sitting here, you know, it's a little bit hard to read it that quickly. Yeah. Having said that things conventionally exist and that we have some possibility of having reliable knowledge about conventional existence, you know, there are a number of different problems are brought up by imaginary opponents in the Great Treatise. One is the one we just dealt with, the idea that, well, you know, there can't be any reliable knowledge of things because the Samadhi Raja Sutra says the senses are not reliable in any way and so forth. So there's this kind of idea that like all of our senses must be wrong because we have these scriptural sources that say it. And so Tsongkhapa dealt with that by, you know, explaining that these are referring to the fact that our senses are completely unreliable in terms of the fundamental nature of things, but it doesn't mean they're completely unreliable in terms of other kinds of practical things we need to know about whether the road's bending to the right or the left, which seems like pretty clear that they're not. Another objection that's brought up is then it's like, okay, well, are you really a Madhyamaka and do you believe in these Madhyamaka analyses that, you know, occur in the Madhyamaka texts? And if you do, then, you know, you keep saying that, you know, these things exist and that they have some actual, you know, existence and therefore some actual arising and coming into existence. And so then, you know, isn't it said that that production is refuted? Because things are not produced from themselves, they're not produced from other, they're not produced from both, and they're not produced from neither. So that, like, that would seem to preclude all possible ways in which they could be produced, and the whole idea of production is thus a fiction which fools fall for, yogis understand to be a fiction, and then sort of enter into this imaginary play world, you know, to guide we fools out of the play world into awakening. But it's not that there can actually be any kind of production, because every possible kind of production and then some was systematically refuted in the Madhyamaka texts, right? It seems like a pretty good, serious, like, yeah, there are a whole series of serious problems like this that Tsongkhapa has to address. That one seems like a pretty serious one, because absolutely, I mean, that this is what these texts say. And Tsongkhapa accepts that and asserts it himself. Chandrakirti, for example, in discussing this, and of course Tsongkhapa is basing himself on Chandrakirti's interpretation, says that, you know, things are not produced from, well, you know, all of the earlier Madhyamaka say things can't be produced from themselves, because if they were, there wouldn't be any reason for them not to be continuously produced over and over again. Once they're produced from themselves, then exactly the same circumstance would be there that was there that gave rise to their self-reproduction, and there would be no reason why it's impossible to explain why they wouldn't continue. If they had built into themselves the power of self-reproduction once, why would that perfect replica not then have the exact same capacity to then self-reproduce itself? And so whatever exists that has this capacity for self-reproduction would have to continuously be reproducing itself forever. So you can't think of something like arising from something that is the same as it or one with it, right? And so then the other leading contender, at least traditionally, I think, would be to say Well, it seems more likely that they're produced from something else. After all, you know, it's like we talk about like cause and effect. That sounds like it's other, seed and sprout. You know, it's like, isn't that one thing and an other? You know, dependent arising is this arises in dependence on that. So mustn't it be the case that things are produced from other things? In fact, one could think that, like, that's what dependent arising means, is a Buddhist not asserting that things are produced from themselves in some mystical way or that they come from God. Buddhist produced suggesting that, you know, things are produced from other things. And but then Chandrakirti says, no, things are not produced from other things. And not only is this true on ultimate analysis, but they're not even produced from other things conventionally. And so it's like, whoa. You know, we're not going to have any way left to produce things if that's the case. So, like, why does he say that things aren't produced from other things? Well, you know, well, a couple. There's a lot of reasons, but I'll just give you a couple that I find, the two that I find more persuasive or easier to get a hold of in the mind. One is that there is a cause and there's an effect, and these are two other and independent and distinct things, one which has the power to produce the other, right? Then you have to say, like, well, where are they in time in relationship to each other? So if the obviously we're going to have the cause before the effect, well, how much before the effect? You start to have a problem. If we have the cause here and we have the effect here, then like how does the power of the cause to generate the effect get from here over to here? There must be something else in here that the cause is acting on that whoops its power up over to the effect and makes the effect come up. But then like what's really causing the effect to come up isn't the cause, it's whatever the cause is affecting in this space in here in time, this time area in here. So you have to like, if the cause is really going to produce the effect, it has to keep getting closer and closer to the effect. And so then you come to this question of like, does the cause contact the effect in time or not? It's like, is there a point when they're right together, or is there not a point when they're right together? Since they're other than each other, you know, you can say like, well, it seems like they would have to be a little bit apart. But as soon as they're a little bit apart, then there's like little space and time in between, and the causal power would have to like somehow work on something in that space and time, which would then be the actual direct cause of the effect, and rather than the thing that we're calling the cause, right? So then you think, well, that's not going to work. We're going to have to wedge them right together, right? If there's no space between them at all, then there's a point where they're right together. That's essentially what you're saying. They have to be like right together. So then, oh, I thought we started with the idea that the cause would be before the effect, but now we're having to put the actual causal working moment of the cause has to be right in the moment of the effect. It's actually not other than the effect anymore, because it's like right there, you know, with the effect at the same time in the same place. You see what I'm saying? It's like they're not really actually other in order for the cause to make the effect to happen. It had to get all the way together with it, right? And so then you have like, you're back to the same problem. So that's one argument, is you can't really like figure out that if they're other than each other, if they're right together, then they collapse in time. If there's any space in between them, there has to be something else in between. And so you can't really, it's hard to think of them as being other. The other example that they give for like how to think about like things not being produced from other things is if things could be produced from things that were, you would say, actually other, there's this thing and there's this thing and they're really other than each other, then other things could produce, I mean, why wouldn't it be the case that any other thing could produce any other thing? There's no, I'll give the example, if you throw on the light switch and darkness extends out into the world. It's like either, you know, it's like if there is a complete otherness between, if there's otherness between cause and effect, then why is it that lighting a lamp makes light go out rather than darkness? It's, well, there's some it's not, well, you know, it's like, well, you don't get it. I mean, lamps make light. Yeah, but like, that's because lamps are light in some sense, you know? And it's like, oh, well, they're not really other than anymore, are they? It's like you're saying light makes light. And you're back to the produced from self thing again, all right? So they give these kinds of arguments and say, well, we have an idea that thing, or if you think, another way to think about this is like seeds and sprouts. It seems, you know, I think about like if, you know, if I were doing a third grade science experiment or whatever it is, and, you know, we have our styrofoam cup and we put the little seed in there and then there's a seed and that's clearly not a sprout. And then later on there's a sprout and it's clearly not a seed. But it's like if you, you know, watch it every hour, it becomes more problematic to say, like, when is the time of the cause and when is the time of the effect? Because it's like there's not really like such a clear way that you can say, like, okay, which one is which? And where the dividing line between, you know, the cause and the effect is supposed to lie. So things, cause and talking about this arising and that is like true conventionally, but it's not dependent arising is a way of like saying, well, we can't capture or find when we go to look for it any kind of way of saying how causes are either the same with or other than or both or neither than their effects. Yet, nevertheless, it seems to be the case that mysteriously, reliably, almost inexplicably, this arises in dependence on that. It seems very mysterious because when we say, yeah, well, how did this arise in dependence on that? Like, was it the same as it or other than it? Then we run into these problems. But if we don't ask, it seems to work just fine. Like when, you know, Josh, you know, plants a pear tree, it doesn't grow up to be an oak. And this, like, doesn't happen, right? But so it can be counted on that if you do good actions, they won't just like through some quantum mystery turn into your falling into hell. Just in the same way with the trees, right? So these things reliably, this depends, arises from that in some way that's both reliable and yet strikes us at least, and not just us, even like, you know, yogis and scholars are writing texts about this. It's just amazing, you know, how all of cyclic existence, everything that we see in dependent arising, the conditions and effects are like, you know, arising, and dependent arising is working, and all of the trees in an orchard are bearing the right kind of fruit. And yet then when you analyze and try to look, you know, well, is this production from self or production from other or both and neither, you can never like find it as any of those things. And yet, well, if it's none of those things, then how could there be any production at all? Well, there's no production such as is locatable under analysis that searches out the real nature of the production. And what's left over when you refute any kind of production such as our mind could like pin down under analysis and say, oh, it must be exactly like this. What's left over is dependent arising, that things like, that's how things actually work. And that's what, of course, you know, Nagarjuna is trying to say. Dependent arising is what is allowed to work specifically because there isn't any analytically locatable type of production. And, you know, I was thinking about this sense of mystery a little bit, you know, because people always say, oh, isn't it amazing? Or it's so wonderful that, you know, even though we can't find how production works, it always seems to that in an importantly reliable way, right? It's not like suddenly when we turn the steering wheel to the right, like the car, you know, spontaneously and inexplicably goes to the left. It's like there's some kind of this arises independent on that, and which our conventional knowledge can sort of get some, as we were talking about earlier, can start to sort out, well, which kind of this would be more likely to lead to the that which I have in mind, you know? And that's exactly what we're trying to do. What causes and conditions can we generate that would be more likely to help us become the kind of being who could be most helpful to others? Or, and more immediately, what kinds of actions could I take or not take, you know, at this moment that would be most helpful to others? You have to be able to make those kinds of distinctions. There has to be some reliability to dependent arising. But it turns out that the way dependent arising is working is inconceivable, is mysterious. So I was thinking about this idea of this, you know, it's like the mysteriousness of dependent arising. And I was thinking, it was like, it strikes us as mysterious precisely because we're the sense of mystery or amazement is one of the, what produces it is exactly the fact that we're so strongly expecting that if it worked, it would have to be working in a way that we could find when we go to analyze it. And we assume that, like, you know, if this is working, then when we analyze this, we ought to be able to, like, pin down exactly here is the substantial, structural, graspable mechanism whereby this works. And we can point it out and say, it's production from other, you know. And it's, and this is why this is, and if it weren't one of those, then, like, you know, it wouldn't work. But since it does work, it must be one of those. And that's... That's like the same thing. It's comparable to the sense that, like, you know, my sense of that I exist in a real and vivid and obvious and self-evident, concrete, substantial way over here. And so then I think that therefore I ought to be able to find myself. When I go and look among my aggregates, I'll find that which is the, you know, the findable self that makes me who I am. And so that kind of like, oh, it's like a little bit disturbing when we start to find that this is like a much bigger problem than we thought. And so usually then at that point, we're like, well, let's think about something else. This is making me a little uncomfortable, you know. But this is like that. When we're searching for ourselves, we get this like almost like somebody scratching on the chalkboard when we start to not be able to point it out. You know, it sets our teeth on edge. But when it's pear trees, like magically growing pears, it's like, oh, it's how wonderful. Cyclic existence has all of these amazing qualities of being able to generate things, even though we can't say, it's like a magician. But then what is the real, you know, the it's all bound up with our karma and afflictions at the same time, right? Anyway, so this is what Tsongkhapa says about this. He actually pulls out a quote to prove that he's not making it up. That's on page 53 in the second revised edition. Chandrakirti says, because things are not produced causelessly, because they're not produced from other causes, such as a divine creator, because they're not produced from themselves, and they're not produced from both self and other, and then the punchline is, the conclusion of all that is not that, therefore, they are not produced at all. The conclusion is, they are produced dependently. So he's able to show that, like, you know, Nagarjuna might not have put that word in, you know, but Chandrakirti made it very clear that dependent arising of sprouts, you know, in relationship to seeds, is exactly what's left over when you refute all of these kind of analytically locatable types of production. It's not that no production is left over, and you know he's got a quote from Chandrakirti to back him up on that. Okay, all right. So now we've been talking about some of what Tsongkhapa says about conventional reality. We're going to talk about emptiness itself now for a little while. This is chapter 6. I'm basically going to like make a few points out of chapter 6, and then we'll go on to grapple with chapter 7. Chapter 6 is called Ultimate Reality Exists Conventionally. Okay, so we started out talking about emptiness, that emptiness is a lack, an absence. It's a point where, you know, Buddha had to choose between a slick marketing move and something that in the long run would be maybe, you know, bitter medicine that would actually heal the patient. And he went for the latter, you know. Let's call it emptiness. They won't like it, but it'll be good for them, you know, in the long run. And it's like, okay, well, you know, as I was saying, it's that emptiness is a negative word that has a negative meaning. And that negative meaning is that it refers to the lack or absence of a certain kind of quality of existence or type of existence in things. So the ultimate reality in this type of Buddhism that's as posited by Tsongkhapa is a negative phenomena or a sheer lack or absence. It's like very, you know, you could say, well, how can you make a religion out of that? You know, it's like, as we were talking about, it's a very kind of disturbing thing. Not just like the word, but then when you find out, oh, it wasn't just the bad, you know, that's actually what they meant. They weren't joking with that negative thing. It's like, oh, it's actually a sheer absence. It's not like an absence is something that, like, no, it's like emptiness is a sheer negation, a complete absence. Now, it's not a complete absence of everything, but it's a complete absence of that false quality, which, due to the superimposition of which, we've been suffering beginninglessly. So, okay, first of all, the first point I wanted to make here is that absences exist. The fact that emptiness is a sheer absence doesn't have anything to do with it being nothing or it not existing. This is like completely not the same, right? There's lots, absences are existent. Lots of absences are existent. It's not just Tsongkhapa who says this. It's like all different kinds of Buddhist philosophers say it. And I've been checking with my Western philosopher friends and they're all fine with it too. You can posit absences as existence. Like the absence of the Potomac River flowing through this room, you know, or I say in the book, the absence of the planet Mars falling down on the learning center and like making it difficult for us. You know, it's like, there's lots of absences and the absence of the elephant in this room. It's like, well, we didn't think of it unless you read the book before. We didn't think of it. If you read the book, then you thought, oh, I'm so happy to see there are no elephants here today. We'll be able to get on with the class. But, you know, it's like, there's lots of, it's like, you know, you, it's like the app, there does exist an absence of elephant in this room. And you can say, well, yeah, if there'd been an elephant here, then everybody would have been distracted by it and, you know, it would have interfered. So one of the existent conditions that makes it possible for us to get on with the class is the absence of elephant in the room. Yeah, but there's also the absence of Mars and the absence of Potomac River and so forth. It's like, well, there's like an infinite, yeah, there's an infinite number of absences here. They all fit in very nicely. None of them take up any space. And but they're those existent things here are things that make it possible for us to do what we're doing. So absences exist. And some kinds of absences can be important. You're thinking, well, why, you know, it's like, but what makes this one particularly important, or why would anyone even talk about it? It's like, well, it's obviously the only reason you ever talk about the absence of elephant in the classroom is somebody were like to think there were one, right? And so that's the point here, is that the absence of inherent existence or intrinsic nature in things becomes important because, unlike the elephant in the room or the Mars and, you know, or the Potomac flowing through, it's like this is something that we not only believe in, but by believing in it, we're causing enormous amounts of harm. So first of all, it's an absence. This absence exists, and this absence is extremely important because it's the lack of something which, unlike the elephant in the room, we really do strongly cling on to, and through clinging on to, we have lots of problems. You know, like if somebody here just had taken something at lunch that made them think that there was an elephant in the room, then we would have to try to help that person, like, get over that mistaken superimposition. So that we, you know, and well, maybe at least get them to leave, but it would be better to like relieve them of the mistake. It's like, because this would be interfering, right? So it's like this. So if we're all going around hallucinating that we have this kind of existence that we never have had, never could have, and due to clinging on to which, we're like then like pouring gasoline on the fire of all of our other afflictions, right? Okay, so that tells you, like, emptiness is the sheer or mere, complete, utter, the utter absence or negation of inherent existence. It exists. It's very important because of the reason I just described. But it still doesn't address the question of, like, why it's the ultimate reality or why it's called the real nature of things or something like that. And that's because, like, unlike... you know, the absence of the elephant, which is like, even if we were all hallucinating elephants, and then it would be all extremely important for us to realize that absence. But it wouldn't be like the real nature or final nature of things. Emptiness is called the real nature or ultimate truth or ultimate reality or the very suchness of things, things just as they are, because it's the, what do you say, the Durlup, the mode of subsistence. It's the way things are. Jimbo was using the final way that things are. It's their final status. That means his final ontological status. That is, you can ask, as we were talking earlier, you can ask a lot of questions about objects. You know, is it this? Is it that? Would it be good for this? Would it be good for that? You know, and so forth. But one, you know, when you ask the question, what is it really? Then on, you know, when your analysis is pushed to the farthest degree, you come at last only to emptiness. So that's the sense in which emptiness is the real nature or the final status of things. It's not, therefore, the only thing that you can say that's useful about things, on the analogy of the duck rabbit. But, you know, it's like if you ask of something, what is it really, right? Then you come to seeing it in the channel B way, the only all emptiness all the time way. And so for each and everything that we can point to, if we ask of it what practical, if we ask of it not what practical use is this right now, but instead ask, what is this really? Then for every X, right, that we can think of, we come at last only to emptiness, right? That's the third point to say about emptiness. And then the next idea, which I alluded to earlier briefly, is that when I say for any X, when you search for it, that X includes emptiness itself. And that is that emptiness, it's not as though everything is empty, but then, and then many people have said this actually in the history of Tibetan Buddhism especially. It's like, okay, the ultimate mind must know the ultimate object. And since that mind knows only reality, that must be the real thing that can be found. Look, if you have a mind that says, what are things finally? And when it searches, what it finds at the end of that search is emptiness, then emptiness must be the thing that's findable by an ultimate mind, and therefore it must ultimately exist. Therefore, it must exist in and of itself, unlike everything else. Mm-hmm. Some people say like that. Are you agreeing?
Yeah, sounds good.
Well, you still like you searched, you can say, what is this really? It's not that your mind found nothing. It's that your mind finally found the emptiness. And so emptiness must be the real truly existent thing, that because it's that which is known by, it must be the ultimate because it's that which is found by the ultimate mind. So when, you know, it must exist in and of itself because it's findable under analysis. Why? Because you did an analysis and you found it. No, that's true. This is like what many people concluded, you know. It's like that other things are not findable under analysis, but whatever you analyze, there is one thing that your mind finally sets upon. So that must be the real thing, right? Mm-hmm. So Tsongkhapa doesn't agree with this. So like, and this is like, of course, the important tradition is to say that emptiness itself is empty. Which, and then how do you explain that? Because like the ultimate mind looking for the nature of the cup did find emptiness. Yes, but it wasn't looking for the nature of emptiness. It wasn't saying in regard to emptiness, what is this emptiness thing really? How does it finally exist? Does emptiness have its own intrinsic mode of being? No, it was asking that question about the cup. When you ask that question about the cup, you find the emptiness of the cup. If you ask the question about emptiness, you find that emptiness doesn't exist in and of itself either. It's ultimately ungraspable. Why? Well, you know, there's many different reasons, but one that Tsongkhapa gives is like, well, emptiness, like everything else, has to be posited in relationship to a mind, posited in relationship to a point of view. It doesn't exist objectively, free-floatingly, apart from the perspective of any mind. It's like there is a mind that arises for a yogi who's finished who's finished, you know, direct non-dualistic meditation, realized nirvana, has, you know, and then comes up out of that meditation and says, oh, I just realized emptiness in a direct non-dualistic way. It was like water poured into water. And then, or maybe they say something else, you know, but whatever they say is like they, at that time, they're saying, you know, oh, that is emptiness. And their emptiness can be positive, is posited in relationship to a mind or perspective that, you know, is like apprehending emptiness, not just like as a free-floating, independent thing. Furthermore, we can say that emptiness is not just like, what do you say, an autonomous reality. It's like a quality of things that are empty. It's like, you know, there's not like the emptiness realm and then there's this world where there's the conventional things, right? That's why we had the rabbit duck. It's like, Yasutani Roshi in Three Pillars of Zen, he's like trying to explain the view and he has this paper fan that he holds up and it's like got this beautiful, very complicated print on one side and then it's blank on the other side. And he keeps, you know, going, you know, form, emptiness, you know, it's like, and I was like, yeah, but I could like take a laser and put it right down the edge of that thing. And then I could just pick which one I wanted, you know? And it's like, that's why I thought, oh, rabbit duck. Because there's no way they could put a laser down the edge of the paper and they'll still have a rabbit duck. Because it's like completely all the way through, you know, it's like not two sides of the same coin, not two sides of the paper fan. No. There are two objects there that, but they co-occupy the same space. And which one you see depends on how you're looking. But they're both filling up the whole base, right? Yeah. It's like all these Zen teachers have this like thing, you know, as I was doing yesterday when we were joking around and say, you know, when the great ancients, well, this is the fifth koan in the Blue Cliff Record, you know, when the ancients reached this, why didn't they just stay there? It's like they reached the pen, they reached the stick. You know, it's like, no, they didn't say pen or stick. They said this. You know, they were pointing out, they were talking about the duck, not the rabbit. You know, everybody's looking, oh, you know, it's a pen. And it's like, oh, well, it's a pen from one point of view. It's also, you know, he's also pointing out the sheer nature of things just as they are. When you reach the sheer nature of things just as they are, like Buddha did, you know, at daylight, you know, under the tree, when you reach that point, why don't you just stay there? Right? Well, because it doesn't help anybody but you. You're gonna have to get up and say some things, you know, that don't adequately express what you've experienced, but you know, maybe can like get some people started in the right direction. Right? Yeah. So emptiness itself is empty. Crucial point. This makes like the big difference between makes it so that you could say, you know, how Buddhism is not anything like a kind of monism, emptiness is in some sense a way of talking about how things are. It's not like sort of a special self-existent substrate that magically expresses itself. It's, you know what I'm saying? It's not a self-existent substrate which due to, you know, illusion temporarily appears as something else, but we could see behind it to get to the real self-existent thing there. It's a way of talking about how all of these things are devoid of any graspable nature. And then if you think, oh yes, but I can at least grasp onto one thing and that's emptiness, then obviously you there's something with regard to which you still have to realize the ungraspability and its nature is interdependent. Like in Sakya, just to briefly, they thought this was a big problem. I think I may have mentioned yesterday, you know, that, well, when people meditate on emptiness and realize that this concept and, you know, conceptual understanding that things are empty, they've gotten rid of, you know, the delusion that was the root of cyclical existence, but now they have a new thing to be attached to. And so, you know, we have to, like, get rid of that. And I was saying, well, you know, Tsongkhapa wants us to cultivate that thought, you know, and try to develop that thought. And so I think Tsongkhapa was not, like, he was not as concerned about like people reifying emptiness because of this idea that if you really understand emptiness and interdependent arising of one thing, you should be able to apply it to other things, and that should relate to emptiness as well, right? It's like if you really know that things are empty, then when you turn your mind to, well, what is the status of this emptiness I believe in, it shouldn't be so difficult to figure out that, oh yeah, that too has a kind of interdependence. So he wasn't as concerned. It's true, it is possible that you can have, you know, a dogmatic view about emptiness, right? But it wasn't, for Tsongkhapa, that was not like the overriding concern that it was for Sakya, because just because you have a concept of emptiness doesn't mean that you have a dogmatic view that attaches to emptiness as intrinsically real. You know, that concept of emptiness is what allows you to understand without too much more difficulty the very fact that emptiness itself is empty in the same way that the cup is. Okay, so now I'm going to skip over to second edition to the bottom of page 61 and talk about this idea of emptiness as the final nature of things a little bit. This is just a bit of a difficult point, is that in Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise, he makes a statement that a nature, or svabhava, or rangshin, is, quote, something that is not fabricated and not dependent on another. He gives that definition of nature, and then he spends, you know, a chapter on this concept of nature. And a lot of different people have, like, different interpretations of, like, well, was that, what kind of nature was he, what does he mean, not fabricated? Is that a good nature or a bad nature, you know, or are we supposed to be, is that like the fact that, you know, is that the nature of this table as like supporting the cup, or is it the nature of things as inherently existent from their own side, or is it the final nature of things as, you know, as ultimately being empty? I mean, nature can mean a lot of things. Which one was Nagarjuna talking about there? And Chandrakirti, perhaps, well, definitely surprisingly to some other commentators, he decided to take this as referring to emptiness. Is saying, well, yeah, the emptiness is as when he said Tsongkhapa, when Nagarjuna referred to a nature as something that is not fabricated and not dependent on another, he was talking about emptiness. That's what Chandrakirti says. So Tsongkhapa is stuck with that. You know, he can't say that that's not the case, because he's, you know, following Chandrakirti. So, you know, Chandrakirti commenting on this, he says, is there a nature that is not fabricated and not dependent on another, as Nagarjuna claims? Yes, because the Buddha said, whether the Buddhas appear or not, the reality of phenomena remains. Does this reality of phenomena that remains, whether Buddhas come to teach about it or not, exist or not exist? Well, if it didn't exist, why would Buddha have taught bodhisattvas to cultivate the path of the perfections? And why would bodhisattvas be asked to go undergo hundreds of hardships in order to realize this reality, if this real nature, if it didn't exist? So therefore, you know, there definitely has to be a real nature that is not, in some sense, not fabricated and not dependent on another, that exists whether or not Buddhas come to teach about it, right? So Tsongkhapa's, you know, could say, loosely, he's stuck with all that because Chandrakirti definitely wrote that as his interpretation of Nagarjuna. And so he goes on to explain what this means. That it's not fabricated means that it's not produced from causes and conditions. It's non-contingent. That is, it's not like this thing of like, well, it doesn't matter whether Buddhas come to teach about it. It's like there's not a possibility for things either. Like, emptiness is the mere absence of things having intrinsic nature. Intrinsic nature turns out to be impossible for things to ever have had. It's not like the elephant in the schoolhouse. It's like very improbable. There isn't an elephant in the schoolhouse, as far as we know. It's highly improbable that there ever has or will be. But it's contingent. We could make provision. Maybe Josh and Diana aren't here, we could all get together and work on this. They would be so surprised. And it's like a contingent. We could ambush them with a little elephant, right? And so it's just small one to start with, but you know what happens. You know, so you know, it's like It's like not like built into the structure of reality that there can't be elephants here. But it is like impossible when you say like, it's not just like, there could be intrinsic nature, and a lot of people seem to think there is, so, you know, maybe there will be someday, even if there's not now. No, it's not like that. It's like a self-contradictory thing. It's something that, like, just, it's impossible for something to be self-existent in and of itself, and then also be engaging in relationships which constitute it. You know, that's the problem. You know, we want things, these things have their own being in and of themselves, but then they're only becoming what they are as they change through interaction with other things. And this is like, it can't be. It can never be. It never has been. So it's like ruled out a priori. It's not contingent upon. And that's what Tsongkhapa says. That's what Chandrakirti means when you say it's not fabricated. It doesn't come about because certain circumstances have led to things being empty. It's just this is like the way things are, right? And so... And then he's able to find other passage where and Tsongkhapa says, even reality, even ultimate truth has no intrinsic nature at all. We can't interpret what Chandrakirti is saying as meaning that that ultimate reality is non-empty. And he's able to find Chandrakirti actually saying that the final nature, which does exist, is neither essentially existent nor essentially non-existent, and that it exists conventionally. So that makes it, you know, clear enough, you know, that he, you know, there is a passage which, if just read out of context, might seem to suggest that there's one thing that's not a dependent arising, and that is emptiness itself, right? But Tsongkhapa says, well, if you look at this in the context of other things Chandrakirti says, you know, we can understand that he wasn't saying that the real nature of things exists in and of itself. He was trying to get across that it's non-contingent. It's a non-contingent aspect of the world. And that's part of what, you know, we could say makes it the real nature, that it's like whenever we search for whatever something is, it's not like we might come up against something other than the emptiness, right? If we just keep looking long enough, maybe we'll find that svabhava. That intrinsic nature is out here somewhere. I have a feeling. It's quite strong intuition. Yeah. Okay, so one other thing I wanted to do in this chapter 6, is... So there's some people, as I was mentioning, who think that contrary to what Tsongkhapa is saying about ultimate truth itself being empty, who think quite precisely that ultimate truth is the one thing that's not empty of its own nature. And this was, in fact, you know, previously we've talked about that Tsongkhapa was pushing back against a lot of people who had, before that in Tibet, who had nihilistic readings of your people all disappeared.
Oh, didn't they?
People had nihilistic readings of Chandrakirti. And by and large, that was the big problem that he was pushing back against. But actually, one of the most popular kinds of Buddhism in Tibet, just at the time that Tsongkhapa was coming along in late 14th century and trying to work out the view for himself, one of the very most popular types was quite different. It was Sherup Gyeltsen's Jonangba school. And this was like all the rage in the 14th century. I mean, it's said that Sherup Gyeltsen was such a great genius and a charismatic teacher and a great yogi and scholar that when he came to Lhasa and to give his presentation of the view that he'd both realized and explained in detail with scriptural citations from Tantra and Sutra and Shastra and everything. When he came to Lhasa to explain it, so many crowds of people wanted to hear it that they would break down the walls of the buildings where he was and collapse the stairways, you know, in the houses where he was, like everyone trying to hear what he's saying. And that they would have, you go outside and they would have to have like relay people to like because they didn't have like amplification, right? So no many people crowded around him. They would have to have some people out here to tell the other people out here and the other people out here, you know, what he was saying. So what was he saying? He was saying that, you know, these things are all empty of any, they're all empty of their own entity. When we look for the cup in the cup, there's no cup that we find at last. But when we refute this graspable nature of things, it's not that that sheer absence of cup in the cup is the reality or the true nature of things. No, it's like we're stripping the muck off the stainless steel counter, and that the absence of muck is not the reality of things. It's what allows the true nature of things to shine out. And that true nature of things that shines out is the ultimate reality, which is has an affirmative dimension to it. It's basically like we are all Buddhas. We are all, in the ultimate sense, perfect Buddhas with form bodies as well as Dharma bodies. The ultimate truth is a complete Buddha body of everybody right now, and not emptiness, right? Emptiness is just the solvent you use to get the gunk off your intrinsic Buddhahood. Right. That's right. So that view is not it comes from combining, you know, different things in Buddha's texts. The most important influence is a text called Uttara Tantra Shastra, which is Gyulama in Tibetan. The sublime continuum, I guess, is in English or something like that. And this text, you know, presents Buddha nature as the ultimate reality and as the essence of things. And that it also teaches that, you know, Buddha is more important than Dharma because Buddha is the ultimate reality of who everybody is all the time, is this perfectly enlightened Buddha within. And so this is not empty of itself. This is findable under analysis, not just the wisdom or wisdom truth body of a Buddha, but even the form bodies of a Buddha, all of the powers and fearlessnesses and virtues and all of the qualities of the Buddha exist ultimately in the Buddha and in us, because we are all fundamentally, ultimately Buddhas with all of these qualities, and those things all exist. Those things are not empty of their own nature. They possess their own self-existence. They're findable under analysis as that. And what they're empty of is everything else. So that's why it's called other emptiness view. It's like there's an ultimate Buddha within that is self-existent and empty of all of this delusory overlay of muck and afflictions and confusion that is keeping us from seeing our pure, true Buddha selves. Okay, and so it's true you have to meditate on emptiness, but that's just like to help you let the self-existent Buddha truth shine out. So this is a very important idea in the history of Tibetan Buddhism. It's called, you know, other emptiness, because instead of saying emptiness means that things lack their own nature, it's like the final emptiness is that this kind of emptiness of something else in which the thing itself is full of itself and you know, can't be broken down, the ultimate thing. And this idea of other emptiness comes down to today in Tibetan Buddhism in many, many, many different forms. Well, I just like to be clear that not all of the Kagyupas and Nyingmas or anybody like who advocates other emptiness views today necessarily advocated in exactly in the way that Sherpa Gelson did. I'm pretty sure they don't, actually. It's much more complicated. But, you know, the idea of talking about other emptiness and focusing on this pure Buddha nature within, and making that the thrust of the teachings rather than emptiness and is ultimate reality and is a sheer negation, was very popular from the generation before Tsongkhapa down to the very present day in Tibetan Buddhism. So Tsongkhapa thought it was terrible. He trashed it in uncompromising language. He didn't mention anybody by name, but his language about it was quite harsh and maybe even not, it's hard to understand that, like, he's really, it's kind of almost like you feel like, well, he hasn't really, like, represented the other person's view. Like, I've tried to give a fair representation, and it's like, he's just like, oh, this is why it's terrible. And he hasn't even gone through fully through the motion of, like, giving you a fair sense of what they're trying to say and why. He just, he says, this is what he says, this is like, this is, these people say that it's necessary to stop the conception of self, the root that binds all cyclic existence. They then assert that you stop this conception by realize, you do not stop this conception by realizing that there's no intrinsic existence in what it apprehends it as, what you apprehend as a self. Rather, you stop this sense of self by knowing as truly existent something else. You have this problem of grasping self here, but the ultimate antidote to that is not realizing the absence of the thing you're grasping onto. No, it's realizing the truly existence of something over there, right? So that's like I'm quoting from the bottom of page 64 on to page 65 in revised edition. And then in order to really, like, tell you how stupid, frankly, he thinks this is, he gives this example. Suppose there is no snake in the east, but someone thinks that there is and is terrified. And you say to that person, hey, you can't stop your idea that there's a snake by thinking in the east there is no snake. Don't bother with that. Instead, you should think there's a tree in the west. That will stop your idea that there is a snake and will end your distress. So, you see what I'm saying? He wasn't being nice, and, like, so when you can read this in the third volume of the Great Treatise, he never names Sherup Gelson, or he says specifically who he's attacking, but it seems pretty clear that, and also in some later books after this, he takes one of his main people that he's attacking and refuting and trying to prove that everything is empty, and that this emptiness of each and everything that you can point at is the ultimate nature, and that's what you have to realize in order to be free, not some other thing, becomes one of the main points of his teaching, specifically because at his time, a huge number of people believed quite opposite of that, and he wanted to be clear about why he thought they were wrong.
You said there was kind of with the Kagyu and Nyingma?
Well, there's a kind of a complicated story to this, but what happened was... the Jonangbo view was the time of the fifth Dalai Lama. The actual books that taught this view were sometimes burned, suppressed, locked up, and so forth. But they continued to exist in eastern Tibet, far away from Gelugpa control centers of control. And then there in eastern Tibet, there was in the 19th century a movement where lots of non-Gelugpas were trying to, like, kind of get together and be more cooperative with each other, and in that way kind of build a common front of, like, ecumenical dialogue, which would kind of be a way for them to push back against the fact that the Gelugpas were so powerful, and so they wouldn't be divided and conquered or pushed out of existence. And so what bound these other people together was this idea of other emptiness. But in order to bind all these different sects and their different teachings, and it's, like, very, very diverse, it's not like Gelugpa where you have, everybody follows Tsongkhapa. All these different schools have different teachings and different ideas. So it's not just like, oh, well, there's three of them, let's, it should be at work. No, it's like lots of different ideas from different lineages. So in order to get these all together, they have it's like a corporate slogan or, brand identity was other emptiness. But what exactly this other emptiness meant was not exactly this. It was, like, different. Every teacher could have their own explanation of different kinds of other emptiness and how other emptiness relates to self-emptiness, as Tsongkhapa explained it. It wasn't like they hadn't read Tsongkhapa. Do you know what I'm saying? So, but it was more like that. That other emptiness became a flag or a banner under which one you could unite people, and it was uniting them in a way that it was against the Gelugpas in a way. But also, you had something that people wanted, which is you're telling them, you are a Buddha, you know, and you just don't know it, you know, instead of saying, you're not a Buddha, but if you do about a million things, maybe someday. And it's like, oh, I'm a Buddha, you know, it's like, so this is like, you know, that was like a much better, so we're talking about marketing, right? It's like how to have good marketing. So. Okay, so that's that thing. So we come to, gosh, this goes very fast. We're up to chapter 7, and we have 5 minutes left in the class. Okay, so there's a lot of talking about like the idea that things existing independence on causes and conditions, and that how that relates to things lacking some ability to exist in and of themselves. So you can say something like I say, this is on page 67 at the beginning of chapter 7. If this school building that we're in existed by way of its own intrinsic nature, then it wouldn't depend on causes and conditions. And then you can easily reflect on the fact that it does depend on causes and conditions. And so, you know, oh, I guess it doesn't exist by way of its intrinsic nature. Or that seems to suggest that, right? And then, or you could say, if the school building existed by way of its own intrinsic nature, then it would never change. And like, well, it's seems to be cleaner than it was last time. And so I guess it's changed, you know? And it's like, so if it's really able to change in this way, maybe it doesn't actually have some intrinsic nature, you know, which is of mustiness. It clearly doesn't. It clearly doesn't, right? So it doesn't have any intrinsic nature. And it's like, so you can use things changing, or you can do this with parts, you know. You can, like we were talking about before, you can say, if school buildings, this is on page 68, if the school building existed by way of its own intrinsic nature, then it wouldn't depend on its parts. And then we can easily think about how it has parts and depends on its parts. It wouldn't exist without its parts. And we think, oh, then, you know, this is like suggesting that it doesn't exist by way of some intrinsic power of the school building itself that spreads out, you know, like mayonnaise through all the parts and glues them together and gives them this self-objective status as a school building. It's just like, oh, it's something that we designate independence on these different parts, right? But here's the thing. People don't go around like being miserable in cyclic existence because they're born believing in some partless particle. We don't go around misery in cyclic existence because we're born believing in a divine creator. You know, these are kinds of different kinds of philosophical constructs that come along, and they're so we say artificial. They're not the innate or inborn, you know, root of cyclic existence. So you're using some things, you know, if you just say, well, if I could just realize partlessness, then I would, there's no partless particle, then that seems like I could realize that, and then I would know emptiness. Well, it's an indicator, just like, you know, the fact of change is an indicator of emptiness, but seeing that things are impermanent doesn't mean that you've realized emptiness itself. It's evidence that's inconsistent with things being non-empty, so it should help you realize emptiness, but it's not the realization of emptiness itself. So the question is, what is actual, you know, what is this intrinsic nature? What would we have to realize in order to actually realize that, you know, that things lacked, if it's not enough to realize these other things, that they're artificial, what is the innate root of cyclic existence? And so, you know, we talk about things being dependent arisings, and we've talked about things depending on causes and holes, like school buildings depending on parts. But Tsongkhapa is saying, like, the deepest fundamental type of dependent arising is dependent designation, that things exist as imputations. They exist insofar as they're designated, mentally assigned or ascribed, you know, in relationship to bases of designation. And that's a little harder to understand, and that's actually the subtle and profound meaning of dependent arising, is dependent designation. And so when Tsongkhapa comes down to it and say, what do you really mean by intrinsic nature? This intrinsic nature that we believe in, that we have to get rid of, it's not enough to just realize these other things. What is it we have to realize? And he says, page 70 in the book, he says, Tsongkhapa identifies the actual object of negation that we're really trying to refute as the idea of that things have their own way of existing without being posited through the force of consciousness. And a way of existing without being posited through the force of consciousness is what Tsongkhapa says. This is what I mean when I keep talking about self as something that we has to be refuted, or intrinsic nature as a synonym of that. It's referring to things having their own way of existing without being posited through the force of consciousness. So we have to like give some examples of this, and this is like one of my main examples, which I got from Jeffrey's book, Tantric Distinction. It's like when you look at what is appearing from the board, you know, it's like there is an A. And we feel ourselves to be receiving the message that's being we're passively receiving a message that's being sent out from the outside, and we're receivers of that message. It's like you didn't write it up there, right? So I wrote it up there, and I wrote an A on the board. So I'm just sitting here waiting to hear what it's about, right? So there's this sense that we have that's like that this is something that's like there, and we're not involved with. It's easy to see, though. Of course, that's why people are smiling. That it's like, of course, we're participating in this. It doesn't like exist objectively from its own side as an A. It's because it's obviously a convention of the alphabet. We're easily able to recognize that we're A-ing it. You know, there's like one little slant chalk mark and a different little slant mark chalk mark, and then the flat one going across, and none of them are A, but when they're big enough for us to see and they're aligned in the right way, you know, on the board, then without being aware of what we're doing, we just go A, and but we don't notice ourselves doing it. We don't catch ourselves in the act of ascribing or imputing or assigning this identity A. In fact, we very much feel the opposite, that it's something that's coming from over there. Okay, so there's like a lot of other examples that we can think of as like the way things. We're participating in constituting the world and designating things as something, and then they're able to work as that, even though they don't have any own nature from their side as being that. We use the A and mantras and letter grades and lots of different things, and it seems to work very well, even though we've just imputed its identity and ascribed that to it. So you think of money. You know, it's an obvious example. Geshe Rabten, used this and said, his teacher and took a 100-rupee note out and say, things are like this. You know, he spent a long time in retreat and meditating on how is it that things are like this? You know, it's like, well, it doesn't have any built-in nature, but then it functions perfectly well. And, it's like that with shovels and hoes and people and, everything. Is able to work even though its identity has being ascribed to it and not coming from some intrinsic quality of the thing itself on its own. And or you can think about, like, I'll just give you a couple more examples and then we'll have to take a break. It's like I didn't use this example in this book, but I talked about it in the other book, Appearance and Reality. It's like thinking about a rainbow. The rainbow is an interesting example. It's like used in a lot of philosophy. Because you can see that, like, there's like something there that's like the basis for, just like there's some chalk marks there, there's something there in relation. Rainbow exists, and we can, there's the rainbow, we can talk about how long it is, whether it's double, and it's like, so there is a rainbow, but it's like, it doesn't exist except insofar as there's a certain perspective, exists in relationship to a certain perspective within which it's possible to make that designation. You know what I'm saying? If there's not like a you're not looking from the right angle or the right point of view, it's not like you're something faulty about your senses. It's just that there isn't a rainbow from that point, that place. There's a rainbow when you're standing in this place and looking in that way. Do you know what I'm saying? So it's like, maybe if you're in the middle of the rainbow, maybe you don't see the rainbow, but like definitely from here, there is a rainbow, right? So this is in this way I'm saying, like, well, that things depend upon mental imputation and not just like, oh, their parts come together and then they're naturally themselves from their own side. No, you know, when their parts come together, there's something that is appropriate for people like us to recognize as that which is appropriately imputed to that collection of things. You know, when there's a certain, when people like us who have our kind of perspective or point of view on the things, you know, see the these marks or see these kinds of, you know, things, then we go table or A or rainbow. And it's appropriate and suitable to make that. But it's not as though it's like there from its own side, independent of our relationship to it or our point of view, which holds it in mind. Tsongkhapa gives this example. He gives this just a raging example. And he said, like, which I have at the bottom of page 71. He's like, oh, you know, is he going to do the rope and the snake thing? In the twilight, someone sees a rope and mistakes it for a snake. Some people, old hands, are going, you know, it's like, oh, the rope and the snake again. How many of those have we seen? But this, he has a twist. In the twilight, someone sees a rope and mistakes it for a snake. Now, suppose we leave aside anything we might know about the perspective of the person who sees the snake. No, that's just that person's point of view. Instead, we ask about what the snake is like on its own terms. So we can't, you know, this is absurd. We cannot begin to discuss the features of the snake objectively, independently of the point of view from which there's a snake. There's no actual snake there. Analogously, suppose we leave aside any consideration of how people and cars and tables appear to ordinary, valid, conventional minds. And then we set that aside. How do these things exist from their own side? What are they like in and of themselves, apart from how they appear to humans and ants and so forth? Well, just now, what are they naturally in and of themselves, apart from how they appear in a certain perspective? There's nothing that you can say that's purely objective, that you can go outside of the possibility of any point of view and like capture and say, oh, it has these intrinsic features. That makes it natural that, you know, these people would see it that way. No, it's like being constituted in relationship. You can only talk about how it is in relationship to these series of points of view. Okay, so now we have a break, and during this break is like, probably there will be some questions, and that will be part of what we'll do in the second part of the next class, which starts at
3:05.
I have 2:35. 3:37. So 3:05.
Thank you, guys.
Happy to do it.
So are you all back at?